Shalom.
It please the court. I'll plan to be brief and just respond to some questions that came up before the break, and doing so with reference to first principles. Our Constitution requires a warrant. That's what we assume. But there are certain exceptions to that warrant requirement, and one such exception is exigency. So when it's impractical for police to obtain a warrant, they can rely on the exigent circumstances exception. The automobile exception is yet a further exception. It's kind of an exception to the exigent circumstances requirement, at least after Witt. And what it says is there are certain times we're not even going to make police prove fact-specific exigency. Instead, what we're going to do is we're going to assume that for this category of cases, we're going to just presume that it's exigent enough and you can search it without either a neutral detached magistrate giving you a warrant or a fact-specific determination of why you couldn't do so. But that's not without limits. And so, Justice Hoffman, to your question about whether or not Ms. Lehrer was seeking a black letter rule, the answer is not a black letter rule on when police can search the car, but a black letter rule on when the automobile exception forgives both the fact that they haven't gotten a warrant and the fact that they haven't shown anything fact-specific in this case. Chief Justice Ravner, to your question about what do we make of the existence of a co-defendant as a passenger in the car, can that bear on exigency? The answer is, of course it can bear on exigency. In this case, the state didn't rely on exigency. The state didn't submit any evidence about how that would impact the ability to get a warrant, but of course it could bear on exigency. Justice Wehner, you asked whether Witt expanded or contracted the automobile exception. I think the answer is it kind of did both. It clarified, it said, we're not going to make you jump through the fact-specific process that Peña Flores had set forth, but we're going to reject the state's invitation that we marry our automobile exception to the automobile exception found under the Fourth Amendment. And so one of those instances was the one that Ms. Lehrer referenced about the impound lot, and there are others.
You agree the federal exception applies anytime there's probable cause to search a vehicle, correct?
I think so. I can't think of but certainly almost always, yeah. On impoundment, just one word, and then I'll go to the second point. But the inventory exception is pretty rigid, right? What it says is you have to have a standard operating procedure and you have to follow that standard operating procedure. And the burden, as in any warrantless search, falls on the state to prove both the existence of a procedure and that they follow the uniform procedure. There might be instances where they can do that. This is not one instance, as you've noted, Chief Justice Ravner, but it's also true that they often can't. I mean, we've had lots and lots of cases where police say, well, we searched it here, and maybe they could have later impounded it and searched it, but they didn't. And because they failed to produce that evidence, that exception to the warrant requirement is not available to them. Just like to say one word about Ireland, and then I'll be done. For a long time, this court and every court has said that there's a difference between probable cause that a crime has been committed and probable cause to search a place, that they're separate inquiries. There is one reading of Ireland, I'll grant you, Justice Hoffman, that seems to collapse that inquiry. I think it's probably not the right reading of Ireland. So we know that the officers smelled alcohol in Ireland. That can mean one of two things. Either they smelled alcohol coming from the body of the car, right? It was on the floorboard or whatever, which you'd think would be probable cause to believe that there's an open container in the car. If that's the reading of Ireland, then it is consistent with longstanding Article 1, Paragraph 7 jurisprudence that says you have to have probable cause to believe you'll find contraband in the place to be searched. If what Ireland meant was that they smelled alcohol on the driver's breath, which is to say that they had proof that he was driving while intoxicated, then it's bad law and needs to be explicitly repudiated by this court. But either way, I think clarification is useful because we know at least one person badly misunderstood when probable cause existed. And that's the trooper in this case who said that whenever I'm making a stop pursuant to John's law, I can search the car. And so it would be useful for this court to explain that that is not the state of the law. Unless the court has any questions.
I just on Ireland, I think though, Ireland probably leaves, I'll say, a little more play than I think even I would give it credit to in the first couple of times I read it. Because it does say, given all the circumstances, right? So it does, I think, leave a little flexibility. And when it talks about the fact that the car had been driven for an unknown period of time, I think it's also then looking at least the idea that there is some flexibility there. But I'm not saying that to disagree with where you are. I struggled with it myself.
And I think that's fair. And unknown is hard. And it's usually going to be unknown, right? I suppose if you see someone get into the car, pull out of the bar parking lot, then you know it hasn't been driven for an unknown period of time. But most often, the amount of time is going to be unknown. But look, it's a fact-specific inquiry. I want to reiterate a point made by Ms. Lehrer that the state makes a lot of hay about the fact that this is a fresh track mark. It's underlined in the state's brief several times, but it's never actually defined. It's never discussed at the hearing. And so a couple of things we don't know. One is, when did that track mark come into his arm? And two, how long is someone high, right? We know he was high. But we don't know how long that, whether that could have been from 8 hours ago or 4 hours ago or 30 minutes ago.
Thank you, Mr. Schlund.
Thank you.
Mr. D'Alessandro.
Thank you. The court's ruling in Witt did not promote a maximal approach for the automobile exception. It recognized that the automobile exception is a series of competing interests that seeks to strike a proper balance to arrive at a just result, recognizing the needs of police officers to conduct investigations, but at the same time, the right of the defendant in this instance to be protected from unlawful warrantless searches. The automobile exception, to the point of, did Witt expand the automobile exception or did it narrow it? In a sense, it narrowed it. And it did that by limiting it to, you need a stop, right? There's much discussion about you need roadside, but you at the very least need a stop. And certainly under these circumstances, there was no stop. There was not a traffic stop for a moving violation. There was not an investigatory stop based off of reasonable suspicion. This was a defendant who was in the police barracks, who under the circumstances had found himself detained. And the state troopers decided to search the car on the belief that they had the automatic right, given the probable cause related to the defendant being under the influence. Witt, however, and this to me is clear, says going forward, the rule is warrantless searches on a roadway with probable cause. And three, that the probable cause arises out of spontaneous and unforeseeable circumstances. The state would suggest that the roadside component of Witt is not relevant. However, it does tie to State v. Alston, which this court in Witt decided it was going back to. Alston very clearly refers to roadside searches on the highway, or searches on the highway. In Smart, the court essentially emphasized, again, the roadside component to the stop. The court in that instance said, you have the automobile exception. We do not intend, these are my own words, these aren't the court's words here. We do not intend nor desire to align with the federal standard. Given that, Article 1, paragraph 7 of the Constitution fortifies New Jersey's automobile exception. And in doing that, it requires that you have spontaneous and unforeseeable circumstances, and you have the inherent mobility of a car, not just the car itself, but the car on the roadway. And that is a quote from Smart. So both before Witt in State v. Alston and post Witt This court has determined that stops on the roadway are what, at least the current iteration of the automobile exception, is intended to, is when it's intended to apply.
But State versus Smart didn't consider whether it was on a roadway or not because it was on a roadway. And Witt didn't explicitly overrule all the cases before Witt that did not involve stops on the roadway, correct? I understand that you're arguing that the cases are bad law, but Witt said that it was specifically overruling only two cases, not Martin or Colvin or...
On that point, Justice, I think it's interesting that the court said it's retreating to State v. Alston, but even though Martin's the companion case, it made no reference to that it was also going to be retreating back to Martin. So while I'm not suggesting that, well, actually, let me back up there. Maybe I am suggesting that there is now a clear demarcation between your roadside versus your parked unoccupied vehicle. Now, to reiterate the points that were made by OPD and ACLU, that doesn't mean that you won't have another warrantless search exception that comes into play. It's just not the automobile exception.
You focused on inherent mobility. How does the presence of a second passenger bear on that?
That's a good question, obviously, Chief Justice. But the second passenger in this scenario, you're referring to...
It was only one passenger.
Correct. That passenger has, in the context of this automobile exception, and respectfully, it has little relevance. I think the overall irrelevance of the second passenger is demonstrated by the fact that the state pays no real attention to it other than mentioning it in the factual background. Two, what I think is critical here is the trooper, if I understand the record correctly in this case, the trooper observed Mr. Fenimore arriving at the police station, getting out of the vehicle. Now, I understand that this the passenger was asleep. I don't know if he was reclined back at the time, but the trooper observed the car arriving at the police station. And then at the time that they're interviewing Mr. Fenimore, they determine that he's under the influence, they detain him. The trooper has decided it is at this moment, because I have probable cause for him being under the influence, I have the automatic right to search the vehicle. And in that moment, he's made a decision to violate the defendant's, Mr. Fenimore's, constitutional rights. So the fact that when the troopers walk out to the vehicle to search the car and they now for certain know that there's another passenger there, I don't think that changes the equation or the analysis. Now, moving it aside from the specific circumstances in this case, the mere presence of a passenger, I was trying to think about this as I was driving down Solo today, but this was a Jeep Grand Cherokee. There's technically five seats. I don't think you could ever say that the passenger gives rise to spontaneous or unforeseeable circumstances, that the passenger in and of itself gives rise to probable cause. Or in this scenario, generally speaking, that the passenger, absent something else, and I'm not suggesting that Mr. Fenimore in this scenario being detained is that something else, but absent something else, that the passenger alone gives you that probable cause to now say I have spontaneity and unforeseeability, I have probable cause, and in this scenario, I don't have a stop, but let's assume a stop for a moment. I now have the right for a warrantless search based off of utilizing the automobile exception.
Let's say the law enforcement is up on a wiretap. And on that wiretap, they, over a course of days, hear one of the defendants talking to a co-defendant and says, I'll come get it. When he says, I'll come get it, they see him get in his car, drive a mile to the co-defendants, and drive someplace else. And they surveil that 3, 4, 5 times. On the 6th time, he says, I'll come get it. gets in his car and drives. Are you conceding that the police would have the right? Are you conceding that the police would have the right to invoke the warrantless automobile exception because he is on a roadway?
Justice Hoffman, respectfully, I'm not. I think actually your scenario is similar to Smart, right? This was a concerted effort to surveil over a prolonged period of time. So, you know, that knocks out, in some sense, it certainly knocks out the spontaneity of it. And in many, if not all respects, it knocks out the foreseeability of it. So in the hypothetical that you just presented, I don't know that it's squarely within Smart, but it's as close as you can get to it. So to return briefly, Witt announced that, one, you need a stop. Two, I would submit that it does require a roadside, given the reference to the highway in Alston and the reference to you need both requirements, inherent mobility of a vehicle on the roadway in Smart. That's element one. That's not satisfied here. We certainly don't have a stop, and it's certainly not on the roadside. Two, we did not, ACDL did not brief probable cause, but I would support OPD and ACLU's arguments that there is no per se bright line rule to probable cause. It's fact intensive, case by case. Probable cause to arrest is not probable cause to search.
No need to get into it.
Okay, thank you. And lastly, on the spontaneity and unforeseeability, I believe I've addressed that in the context of the passenger, the roadside stop, or the stop in and of itself. But overall here, my one comment on that would be the circumstances in this case come nowhere close to saying with some conviction that it was impracticable for the troopers, for the state, to obtain a warrant in these circumstances. There's no practical reason not to, and there was no compelling reason not to. If your honors have any questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Brigham.
Good afternoon, your honors. May it please the court. The state has four main points in response, and I'm first going to address why the automobile exception applies to parked cars generally, and then why it should apply to the parked car here. First, it's a longstanding, well-settled principle that the automobile exception is not limited to the counters on the side of the road, but also applies to parked cars, like the parked car here. In Witt and Penn site 447, this court returned and restored Alston. And on the same day Alston was decided, this court held in a companion case, Martin, that the automobile exception applies to, quote, parked and unoccupied vehicles encountered by police in public parking lots or on city streets, as well as to moving vehicles stopped on the open highway. And since Alston and Martin, and even under the more restrictive Cook and Pinaflores standards and through Witt, this court has for decades applied the same automobile exception standard to all vehicles that was in effect at the time, whether the vehicle was parked or moving at the time of the encounter. This longstanding principle should apply to the car defendant parked at the station's public parking lot here, which had yet to be impounded. As the appellate division held, Witt's precise language did not hold that the automobile section was solely restricted to roadside encounters. It recognized at Penn site 447 to 48 that the automobile exception may apply to parked cars where circumstances giving rise to probable cause are unforeseeable and spontaneous. Leading me to my second point, the appellate division also properly found that the exigencies inherent to an on-scene search had not dissipated here, for the car had yet to be towed and impounded. The limited exigency that remains under the Alston standard is the unforeseeability and spontaneity of probable cause and the inherent mobility of the vehicle. And about this, this court held in Alston, which remember Witt was returning to, Alston held two critical things about that on-scene inherent exigency. First, that the one, that the ready mobility of a vehicle is applicable to the vehicle itself and remains ready movable until such time as it's securely impounded by the police. And two, that exigent circumstances justifying the automobile exception search do not dissipate simply because the particular occupants of the vehicle may have been removed from the car, arrested, or otherwise restricted in their freedom of movement. As the state explained in its supplemental brief for Witt, the limited exigency under Alston exists the moment probable cause arises unforeseeably and spontaneously, and it doesn't dissipate until that car is impounded. The search of defendant's vehicle here in an unsecured parking lot prior to impoundment thereby fell squarely within the principles articulated in Witt and Alston. It also fell within the principles of the Peldevin's decision in Courtney, which was emphasizing that automobile exception searches are precluded after the vehicle has been impounded, drawing a distinction between on-scene searches and post-impoundment ones, specifically holding in the context of John's Law that before impoundment, police have discretion to do an immediate search under the automobile exception, even if impoundment is anticipated. Lead me to my third point, which I'm about to go into why there was probable cause and how it rose unforeseeably and spontaneously. The automobile exception here should apply to this specific car because those two critical elements of Witt were met. Similar to what was found in Ireland, which has remained good law for nearly 20 years, the salient facts that were known to the officers, that defendant reasonably appeared intoxicated due to narcotic use, that he had recently consumed a narcotic based on the fresh track mark on his arm, and that he had recently occupied the vehicle he drove to the station for some unknown period of time, provided probable cause to believe that a narcotic by way of a needle had been used in the vehicle he had just been seen operating, and that the vehicle may have contained more narcotics or other drug paraphernalia. Probable cause is not a high standard, it's a fair probability, and this court expressly acknowledged in Pierce that evidence of DWI offense or operating a vehicle while possessing CDS is often orally found in the implicated vehicle. The probable cause to search defendant's car did not exist before his arrival. Those circumstances swiftly unfolded during an unplanned DWI encounter after defendant chose to drive to the station while impaired and park in the station's public parking lot. This case is wholly unlike Smart, where the police had been deliberately surveilling Smart at length at various locations for drug trafficking before conducting a deliberate investigative stop of Smart's car because they suspected it contained drugs, and then called a canine to develop probable cause to search the car after the driver refused consent to search. Nothing like that happened here. Fourth and final point, which is going into the search incident to arrest.
Leave the third point. To what extent is it relevant that the officer received potential intoxication based upon his telephone conversation with Mr. Fenimore?
So on the phone, the officer says, after he hangs up the phone, he says, I think it's possibly intoxicated. But at that moment, it wasn't foreseeable the defendant was going to then get into a car and drive while intoxicated and commit a crime. The fact that the officer said, I think he's intoxicated at that point, didn't provide probable cause to search a car that the detective had no idea that the defendant was in.
Didn't Mr. Fenimore say in that conversation, no thanks, don't need a ride, we'll drive myself?
The officer offered to pick him up at work and defendant declined the offer, but defendant again chose to drive a car there instead of having a sober friend or family member drive him there, taking a bus, taking an Uber.
Is it relevant that at the end of that conversation, am I right that that was mentioned on that same phone call? That I'll drive myself? Mr. Fenimore said that in the same phone call where the officer thought he was potentially impaired?
I believe it is, Your Honor, yes.
So by the end of that phone call, he knows two things. Potentially more. One is he sounds impaired. The other is he said he's about to drive himself.
But the defendant doesn't arrive at the police station until about 2.5 hours after that phone call, which was plenty of time for him to sober up before he drove to the police station. So it wasn't foreseeable here the defendant was going to drive while intoxicated when he arose at the police station. That developed based on Radicich's observations when the defendant arrived there, which was he happened to be in the lobby to see defendant's arrival. He saw the defendant get out of the driver's side of the car. When he's walking into the station, he almost stumbles and falls into the wall when he's trying to get into the front entrance. He's immediately taken into an interview to be interviewed about the unrelated harassment complaint. And during the interview, the officer is watching defendant and he notices signs, he's a drug recognition expert. He notices recent signs of narcotics use, his pinpoint eyes, his slow and raspy voice, and most significantly, the fresh track mark on his arm.
Can you tell us a little bit about the qualities of a fresh track mark? How long do they persist? And what, if anything, is in the record about that?
Well, a fresh track mark in and of itself, the term fresh means, it's common sense what fresh means.
But in the context of a track mark on somebody's arm, somebody who's using drugs might not be that common. I don't think it is.
Does it look the same 10 minutes ago, 30 minutes ago, 3 hours ago? Do we know anything about that in the record?
There's not testimony as to what a fresh mark would look like 3 hours ago versus 10 minutes ago versus 30 minutes ago. However, I would submit it's common sense. If you have a track mark that's 3 hours old, it's going to start being scabbing over. If you have a fresh track mark, there hasn't been signs that it's scabbed over. It's
so
evidence
is it
that
bleeding is. I mean, what we're trying to get some sense of what that means. what is a fresh track mark on someone's arm? Is it?
It doesn't
bleeding. Is it? I mean, what does that look like?
It doesn't have to mean bleeding. It just probably means it hadn't scabbed over yet, which was based on the totality of circumstances here, where defendant was driving a car while intoxicated for in some unknown period of time and arose with a fresh track mark on his arm. Remember, probable cause is not a high standard, it's a fair probability standard. Those circumstances provided a fair probability that he could have used those drugs while in that car, and there would be evidence of the drug use, drug paraphernalia, like more narcotics or a hypodermic needle in that car. And in fact, they were right there in the center console.
The track mark, of course, comes from use of a needle, right?
Yes.
So if you have blood drawn in a lab, are you suggesting that leads to scabbing always? If you go and have your blood drawn and they put a needle in you to take a sample for medical purposes, entirely legitimate, does that leave scabbing?
Later, after blood's drawn where the injection of the needle mark was, usually there's signs of healing or scabbing there. So yes, that is what I'm submitting. But here, I'm not trying to suggest that every time you see a needle mark on somebody's arm, that suddenly gives you probable cause to search a car. It's a totality of circumstances analysis. And here you have his appearance of intoxication, the signs that the officer is recognizing for recent drug use, in combination with that fresh track mark on the arm and the fact that he was driving a car for some unknown period of time. That's what provided the probable cause to search the car for intoxicants.
Do you know how long his trip was in the car?
I do know from the record that when defendant was speaking to Radicich on the phone, that he said he would be there in 10 or 15 minutes, and that didn't happen. So presumably based on that, it seemed, and he he must have lived in Salem County. It seemed like he was nearby, but he didn't arrive to the station until about 2.5 hours.
He tells the officer that he'll be there in 10 or 15 minutes. I think earlier you mentioned in response to Justice Patterson's questions that there was no indication that he would, that defendant would drive while intoxicated. But if he told the officer, I'll drive myself, and the officer believed he was intoxicated, then that may have been an indication that he was going to drive intoxicated, notwithstanding the fact that he didn't arrive until 2.5 hours later.
But that's not exactly how the probable cause factors developed here. I understand.
No, I understand. And Justice Patterson was asking what impact did the fact that and it told the officer, I'll drive myself. The officer says he sounds like he's intoxicated. What impact that had? But you had indicated, well, he showed up 2.5 hours later. There was no indication he was going to be driving drunk. But now it sounds like he did indicate he was coming very soon, initially.
But he didn't come soon. He didn't come until 2.5 hours after the fact. And I think what
you're saying, had he shown up 10 to 15 minutes later, perhaps there would have been probable cause to believe that he had driven intoxicated. But then when he didn't come until 2.5 hours later, they needed something else. It couldn't just be the fact that he suspected that he was intoxicated 2.5 hours before.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
In terms of the justifications that support the automobile exception in Witt, the case discusses concerns about officer safety, officer's ability to secure a vehicle and ensure nothing is removed, the possibility that third parties could access the vehicle or something in it. So those are kind of two ways of saying something similar, and then officer safety is a second one. How is any of that possibly implicated here when the car is outside of state police barracks?
So the inherent exigency that Courtney was talking about that exists after that.
I'm not asking about Courtney, though, because that's only a case of the appellate division, correct?
Right. So
talking about the concerns that Witt talks about, officer safety, ability to secure the vehicle, ability to ensure nothing is removed from the vehicle. How could any of those possibly have been in play with a car parked at state police barracks?
So I have two responses. The first is it doesn't have to be shown anymore for a case specific exigency. It's now an inherent exigency that's assumed. And the second is
defendants argue that the inherent exigency only applies on a roadway to a roadside stop. Even if we weren't going to go that far, how could we not acknowledge that the concerns that are relied upon in Witt just cannot apply outside of state police barracks where officers are safe because they are in their home base. They are able to secure the vehicle. They are able to ensure that nothing is removed from the vehicle. There were 5 officers who were involved in this search. The car was being watched the entire time, and it's at state police barracks.
So the inherent exigency is not just about safety. It's also about control to third-party access, as Your Honor was saying. And that's shown directly by Alston when Alston is talking about the ready mobility of the vehicle.
You could understand how third party could perhaps gain access to a car in a Walmart parking lot where the police would have to deploy many officers to stand around the car for many hours to make sure that no one goes inside. How is that possibly true at state police barracks where there's obviously a visual from inside the barracks to the parking lot, because here the trooper testified that he could see when the defendant got out of the car that he almost fell, et cetera. How is that remotely similar to a public parking lot?
It's because like a public parking lot in a store, the same concerns arise at a public parking lot in a police station. And that's about control to third-party access. Here, that's realized because...
Sorry, so the concern is that a third party will steal a car from the state police barracks parking lot with visibility from state police barracks to the parking lot itself.
The potentiality, yes. That's the inherent exigency that exists here. And here it was realized because there was a passenger in that car that had to be secured.
But the passenger was secured.
The passenger was secured during the process of trying to make that car safe in order to be searched.
Understood, but once the passenger was secured and the driver is inside, and I think it mentioned in the facts that he was handcuffed to a bench in a holding area. So the driver is handcuffed to a bench in a holding area, the passenger is secured. Why can't the police at that point get a warrant? What could possibly happen to that car outside of state police barracks?
It's because of how the limited exigency under Alston is met and when that arises. So the limited exigency under Alston is the spontaneity and unforeseeability of probable cause and the inherent mobility of the vehicle. And
Alston is not talking about a car outside of police barracks, correct? Alston does not talk about a car parked outside of state police barracks, correct?
It's not dealing with that specific situation, but it is talking about cars generally, and it's trying to apply the rationales for the automobile exception that were met here.
And you think those rationales apply equally in a public parking lot of any kind of store and state police barracks?
It could be diminished here, but they still apply. And because the car was pre-impoundment, that's why the police could do an immediate search on scene.
Doesn't that just create an incentive to always search before the impoundment? Because if you need a warrant once it's impounded, but you never need a warrant before it's impounded, as long as it hasn't been impounded yet, then isn't there just an incentive to search without a warrant before impounding? Meaning, I'm not sure why the argument that it was pre-impoundment helps you. If we know that once there is an impoundment, you need a warrant, but here otherwise the circumstances are very similar to an impoundment, it's hard to see how that might not create an incentive to search without a warrant before impounding, because you don't want to wait till it's impounded because then you'll need a warrant.
If it's incentivizing to search before impoundment, that's acceptable under the rationales for the automobile exception. There's four main rationales, and there's two additional interests at play here. The four rationales, one of which I've already gone over, is the inherent mobility of the vehicle, how it applies to the vehicle itself, and it's readily mobile until it's impounded. That's a holding directly from Alston. The second rationale is the lesser expectation of privacy in vehicles based on the pervasive government regulation of vehicles, and that applied to the car here. The third rationale is about how going through the process of impounding the car could be a greater intrusion on the driver and occupants themselves. That was realized here for two reasons. One is that if the rule is that a warrant always has to be acquired, that's going to delay, in cases, the release of those occupants, because the occupants aren't going to be released until it's determined what's in that car for a complaint summons or a complaint warrant. And in many cases, a driver and occupants may just be issued a complaint summons and go on their merry way. But if a warrant is always required, it's going to delay the release of those people more.
But a warrant is not always required. And those facts that you just explained aren't the facts here. You argued that there was a greater intrusion in this case, but the defendant was already arrested. He wasn't going anywhere. So waiting to get a warrant for the car that was already in the parking lot, police barracks parking lot, in a secure place, easily secured, could have easily been secured by the officers, doesn't seem to really go to those concerns with regard to the greater intrusion on the passengers and the driver and, you know, having them stand on the side of the road and wait a significant amount of time for a warrant to be issued. It doesn't seem like that. I'm not sure how that applies here.
Defendant may have been arrested, but he hadn't been issued a complaint summons or complaint warrant yet. So until he was issued, until they knew what was in the car, what charges to bring for him in a complaint summons or a complaint warrant, he wouldn't have been released.
Is it reasonable to think he would have gotten a complaint summons while he was visibly intoxicated?
He was issued a complaint summons in this case. At what specific time was he issued the complaint summons?
After
the search.
Hours after the search?
I don't know about hours after the search, but after the search.
He was arrested. There was probable cause to arrest him on particular charges, correct?
On the DWI offense, but they had probable cause to search the car, and they weren't going, they're not going to release a defendant until they know what's in that car to see what charges to bring. And that's why there's another interest at play. But
they had about charges already. There were charges available on the DUI at that point. They could have arrested him on the DUI, and that would have been enough, and they could have held the car for 12 hours under John's law, right? They didn't have to look into the car to see what other charges to bring. Sorry, go ahead. Answer the question as far as whether or not they could have issued other charges.
That may be true for the defendant here, but the line isn't drawn between anticipated impoundment and non-anticipated impoundment. The line is pre-impoundment and post-impoundment, because pre-impoundment, you have the rationales of the automobile exception that exist, and the inherent and exigency that applies to those types of searches.
What was your fourth rationale? You said you had four total rationales, and then I got inherent mobility of the vehicle, lesser expectation of privacy in vehicles because they're pervasively regulated, and the process of impoundment could be a greater intrusion. What's number four?
Number four is one specific to New Jersey, and it's that the circumstances giving rise to probable cause unforeseeably and spontaneously arise swiftly. And here that was realized too.
Can I ask you a question about probable cause? I've understood your position with regard to what the state submits was a probable cause in this case. Can you explain whether or not Trooper Radetich defined it properly when he said, in response to the question during the hearing, why didn't you get a warrant? The response was, it's my standard practice that if you're arrested for John's law, you have the right to a probable cause search of their vehicle, and we search their vehicle for intoxicants. That was then repeated by the prosecutor in their concluding arguments that the police have the right to search for intoxicants after a DWI arrest. Once they search and find intoxicants, that gives them probable cause to search the entire vehicle and any containers they're in, which essentially gets them to the bag where the gun is located. Is that the proper standard, or is it what you've talked about today regarding the track marks and the totality of the circumstances?
It's the totality of circumstances.
So this standard that the trooper enunciated there in his response to the question, why didn't you get a warrant, is wrong.
It wouldn't have been the correct standard, no. However, for a search and seizure analysis, it's not dependent on the subjective motivations of the officer. It depends on the objective reasonableness of their actions. And here their actions were objectively reasonable.
So we talked before about the phone conversation. I think Justice Patterson asked you about the implications of Radetich identifying that he was inebriated. But that's not all that predated Fenimore's arrival in Woodstown. The investigation was actually about the fact that, or the allegation, that Fenimore would drive while intoxicated and harass people. So he was investigating. When he asked Fenimore to come in, he was investigating an allegation that Fenimore drives while inebriated. And then on top of that, while he's on the phone with them, he identifies him as being inebriated. I struggle to see how it could be that it was so spontaneous and unforeseeable that then Fenimore arrived in Woodstown inebriated.
So it was unforeseeable and spontaneous within the meaning of the automobile exception, which doesn't apply a dictionary definition for those terms. If it did apply a dictionary definition, everything would be foreseeable to an experienced law officer when they're taking steps to investigate a crime. So that can't be what those terms mean. What those terms mean an unplanned encounter where the circumstances are swiftly unfolding. And those were met here. The fact that your Honor mentioned about the text message where he possibly hit somebody while high, or the fact that the officer mentioned on the phone after he hung up with him before the defendant's 2.5 hour arrival to the station, though that didn't come nowhere close to providing probable cause to search the car the defendant arrived in. And it wasn't foreseeable that he was going to commit a crime. Probable cause didn't arise foreseeably and unforeseeably and spontaneously until defendant arrived to that station intoxicated and impaired and emerged from the driver's side of that vehicle.
Do we know when it was alleged that defendant was harassing people and had allegedly hit someone with his car while intoxicated? Was it the same day? Was it day before? Weeks before?
It's some previous unspecified time. There's no indication in the record about when it occurred.
You said when they got off the phone, Radetich expected him to come much sooner. So how then, I still struggle then with the idea of I'm investigating someone who drives while inebriated. They're inebriated. They're going to drive in. I expect him to drive in quickly. How's it not foreseeable then that he could be driving while inebriated?
If that's how the circumstances unfolded here, this case would be harder than it is, but that's not how they unfolded here because defendant didn't arrive to that station until 2.5 hours later.
That's, Radetich says it's an hour or two. That 2.5 hours is based upon the CAD entry for the beginning of the interrogation at 8:29, right? That doesn't necessarily mean that that's when he arrived at the station.
It's based on, so there's an entry for a phone call at 6:04, and then a CAD entry, you're right, at 8:29 for the interview. And he arrived within 2.5 hours, which corresponds to the officer's testimony that it was within an hour or two.
Please go ahead.
If your honors have no further questions, I'll move on to my fourth point.
I have one other prior point. This follows up on something that Chief Justice Ravner was asking. What training did Trooper Radetich have with regard to identifying sort of the temporal component of a track mark?
The testimony is that he was a drug recognition expert, that's at 1T77-3-4, and that he had 6 years of law experience of encountering people under influence of drugs and alcohol. And based on that, when the officer saw the defendant's pinpoint eyes, slow, raspy voice, write stuff on the side of his mouth, which I want to be candid to the court, it's due to a dry mouth, it's not drugs, but he did recognize that as a recent sign of narcotics use. That in combination with the fresh track mark on the arm and the fact that he had emerged from the driver's side of the vehicle that he drove intoxicated, impaired to the police station for some unknown period of time is what gave the probable cause to search the car for the intoxicants.
Your fourth point.
I'll move on to the fourth point, which has to do with the searches and into arrests exception. Here, the car was alternatively justified on the search incident of wreck exception. As per Gann, it was reasonable to believe under the totality of circumstances that evidence relevant to defendant's DWI offense would be found in the car he was just seen operating, thus satisfying Gann's second scenario for
how
a search
incident. How could Gann possibly call Echol into question if Echol is based on state law that has intentionally departed from federal law and is intentionally only allowing search incidents to arrest in cases that are much narrower than federal law? So why would a development on the federal side have any impact on Echol?
So Echol intentionally departed from Belton federal law. Gant hadn't been decided at the time that Echol was, and this court has not yet addressed the second scenario of Gant, which is based on Justice Scalia's concurrence in Thornton that's tethered to evidence preservation and is based on the logic that it's common sense evidence of arrest might be in the car the defendant was just in. A majority of jurisdictions, there's 29 states, DC, three other unpublished cases to have a majority of 33 are applying the second Gantt scenario, and the state has
presented. The majority of the states are also applying the federal automobile exception. I did some research into this, and it looks like a majority apply it, and New Jersey does not, because New Jersey has prior precedent that says that our state constitution protects beyond what the federal constitution protects, and that's what happened in Echol. So I'm asking, why would Gantt call that into question, even if it hadn't been decided yet? It's just a separate track. Echol says the state constitution protects beyond what the federal constitution protects. And so regardless of what Gantt says, how does that call it into question?
Because there are two different exceptions to the warrant requirement that are based on different rationales. I've already gone through the rationales for the automobile exception. There's different rationales for the search incident to arrest.
Echol was about search incident to arrest, no?
Echol was about searches and arrest, and it departed from Belton the same way that Gantt did later. And then Gantt considered a fresh perspective, Justice Scalia's concurrence in Thornton, that this court has not yet addressed. So the state has presented it so the court can consider it in judicial comity with the majority of jurisdictions that have considered and are applying the second Gantt scenario.
When did you first raise this issue?
It was first raised before the appellate division. However, there's a full record for this court to consider it if the court wants to. And if the court could remand so the defendant, she mentioned she didn't have the opportunity to write a brief. Well, that could be corrected by remanding and fully briefing the issue further.
Was the defendant parked inside or outside a gate at the barracks?
It's parked in the public parking lot outside the lobby. And I'm not sure the barracks has a gate that's unsecured. And I'm not sure if the defendant was parked outside that or inside it, but the gate's not like an impoundment fence that has barbed wire. You need permission to go behind there. It's not any sort of like an impoundment facility.
You don't know where the defendant was parked?
No, I don't.
Counsel, given the admonition and wit to beware of warrantless searches that are based on fake exigencies, are we to make anything of the officer's comment on the body-worn camera that I knew it when the gun was found?
So the officer said that when he was feeling the plastic bag where the gun was wrapped in a towel and he looked inside and he said, I knew it. So I believe in context that I knew it was because of the plain feel of touching that bag and not because he expected to find a gun in the car.
I'm not sure if I understand the distinction you're drawing.
When the search was unfolding, the plastic bag with where the gun was wrapped inside a towel was found in the rear compartment area. And when the officers took it and was manipulated and looked inside, he said, I knew it.
Meaning it's implying that he knew he was about to find a gun, or he knew he would find a gun.
after touching the bag and the towel and feeling what could have been in that bag and looking inside, yes.
Meaning he expected to find what he found.
After he was touching the bag, not before the search ensued.
We have no way of knowing what was correct, though, right? Whether he thought that before the search began or whether he thought that just seconds before touching the bag.
I believe that's supported by the record that he said, "I knew it," after he was touching the bag during the search. So
trying to tell us when the idea first came into his mind, and looking at the last moment when it was confirmed doesn't tell us when it first popped into his head, right?
Even if it was the former, as I was explaining before, the officer's subjective motivations doesn't matter so long as his conduct was objectively reasonable. And that's based on this court's holding in Gonzalez 227 NJ at 96, which we've stated that even under our state constitution has firmly eschewed any consideration of the subjective motivations of an officer and determine the constitutionality of a search or seizure. That's at Penn site 81 and 98. What matters is whether the conduct is objectively reasonable, and the conduct was objectively.
Does it go to the spontaneity issue? The unforeseen spontaneous aspect of
No, because there wasn't probable cause to search for a gun. There was probable cause to search for the car for intoxicants, and that's what arose unforeseeably and spontaneously. And the state still submits that the officer said, "I knew it," when he was having the plain feel of the bag.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
Just short concluding remarks. The appellate division had a thoughtful and well-reasoned decision, properly uphold the search under the automobile exception here, and the state would ask this court to affirm that well-reasoned opinion.
Thank you. Ms. Lehrer, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm going to make two factual points and two legal points, so hopefully it'll be short. The first, there's nothing in the record about this kind of parking lot. I was hearing stuff about secured, barbed wire. There's nothing in the record about this parking lot. The state has the burden. And as this court has said in many cases, but Myers Naima comes to mind first, the party that has the burden cannot benefit from failing to put forward evidence. And this, by the way, I know I said legal, fact and legal, maybe this is both. This is why a road is a road is a road is very clear. And then for parking lots, we can deal with the tenor of parking lots on a case-by-case basis that creates exigency, how much of the police force is available, how long it takes to get a warrant in this circumstance. Some parking lots are private and some are public, and some places have both. I'm not allowed to park underneath this building. I park outside. Other public defenders can park inside. There's a lot of facts here. So instead of focusing on whether a parking lot is public or not in order to create some sort of rule, I would submit that the road is a very clear rule. It's a rule that furthers the purposes of WIT, and we can deal with the facts of parking lots as they arise, but we don't have any facts here. The second thing is this 2.5 hours thing. That's DSA 24 to 26. I don't know what this CAD report means. And, you know, maybe I'm dumb, but this issue was raised by the defense attorney at 114 in her summation. She even says, "I don't know how long it took him to get here." And the state doesn't get up and say, "Wait, like, this is the obvious way to read the CAD." It says call answered at 604. Same thing as created, dispatched. Does that mean the trooper answered a call? I don't think that means that Fenimore answered a call. We have to remember that the trooper called his mother first. I have no idea, but neither does the state. And so it's suggesting that this should be read in a certain way when the state failed to put forward information that would answer this question is inappropriate. Though I'd also note that the longer it took, the less spontaneous and unforeseeable the outcome is. In terms of the law, I just want to flag two things. The first is that this idea that someone being high and driving means you can search their car not only proves too much in DWI cases, but it proves too much in a lot of cases. I walk to court in Newark. I live in Newark. I walk to court in Newark. If I walk through security and I'm high and they frisk me and they find drugs on me, well, she came from her home. people who do drugs have drugs in their home. She wasn't in a car. Is that probable cause to get a warrant for my home? That's obviously not probable cause. And obviously homes are more protected than cars, but the fact of a car does not eliminate our constitutional protections against unreasonable searches and seizures. And the last thing that I will conclude with is Colvin. As discussed, I think what this court said in Witt is that Colvin is a pure exigent circumstances case. But insofar as it sheds light on the automobile exception, I think this quote from Colvin is something that I'd like to leave you with. No case has established the proposition that law enforcement officers in every conceivable circumstance may dispense with the warrant requirement in the context of an automobile search. Rather, the expression automobile exception is a shorthand way of stating the circumstances under which law enforcement officers may conduct a warrantless search of the car. When this court wrote in Witt, roadside stop, that is the set of circumstances under which the automobile exception excuses the need to get a warrant. It does not apply anytime a car is found. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to counsel for the helpful arguments. We will take the matter under advisement. Court is in recess for the day.